Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. This week, Ross Clark. He's the author of a brand new book, The War Against Cash. Also, we speak to Zaria Phillips. She's from Bath Against the Cuts. She's also the chair of something called Unite Community. The first part of a two-part interview with her this week. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Ross Clark. I'm a freelance journalist. My book is called The War Against Cash, The Plot to Empty Your Wallet and Own Your Financial Future and Why You Must Fight It, which is about the rather sort of underhand plot to turn our economy cashless so that we could only pay for things electronically via bank accounts, contactless cards, mobile phones, and have you.
Well, the obvious thing, Ross, is actually it's surely much easier to empty your wallet of cash than it is to take electronic money from you, because, you know, basically you're protected from electronic theft, whereas you're not from the theft of cash.
Well, theoretically, that's what the cashless lobby tell us. It's one of their arguments. Well, it'll cut out crime because cashless payments are traceable, whereas cash payments are not. But it just doesn't really stand up to examination. In 2015, Britain's lost a total of £750 million on online fraud. You know, the criminals have gone cashless. They have no trouble extracting money from our pockets electronically. We know the scams and the frauds that go on. It's much easier in a way to transfer money around, launder money electronically than it is physically. I mean, if you try and carry a suitcase full of money through any airport, or certainly in the United States where they use cash sniffer dogs now, dogs that have been trained to sniff out ink on banknotes, you're liable to get caught. Whereas, you know, we learned this week that the number of cash mules who are being used by criminals to transfer money electronically around the world, there doesn't seem to be any effort going on to catch cashless criminals. If you go to your local police station and say, I've had some money stolen from me online, you won't get a very warm reception. It'll just be, well, just be more careful next time. It seems to be, whole area of crime seems to be treated just as a sort of kind of occupational hazard of using online banking.
I mean,
service.
Surely there's this organization called Action Fraud, which is supposed to look at this kind of crime actually very carefully.
Well, it's supposed to, but just because transactions are theoretically traceable doesn't mean that anybody is actually doing the tracing. As I said, you know, £750 million was lost by British consumers in 2015 as a result of online crime. In Sweden, which is further down the road than any country on the sort of cashless journey, as the payments industry like to call it, the year after that the banks there introduced a mobile phone payment system called Swish in 2013, the next year the amount of cashless crime rose 37% because you know, it's not as secure as it claims to be.
What about attacks like we had this cyber attack on the NHS earlier this year, where someone is actually demanding electronic payments? Is there any way to stop that kind of thing? So I think that's one of the, you know, basically, I think they call it ransomware, where you're being held to ransom. You've got to make an electronic payment if you actually want to get your computer back working.
Well, exactly. And how many of those people get caught through the tracing of these payments? I mean, that cyber attack was foiled by an amateur hacker who was what they call an anti-hacker, or
who was later, by the way, he was later arrested by the FBI when he went to the United States to a conference.
Yes, you're quite right. But whatever went on there, I don't know. But it was sort of his public-spirited act which ended that cyber attack. Not the sort of authorities whom we charge with tackling online crime.
Yeah, so what's going on with the authorities? Why, for example, in a situation like that, cannot the people be traced? I mean, surely there is some kind of electronic trail that can be followed by police or by other sorts of law enforcement to find who it is that's the final recipient of this money.
Well, theoretically, yes, it can be traced, but the problem is it's quite complex to do it, and you know what happens if you get money stolen from you online. 5 minutes later, the money's been spirited abroad, and the police authorities in this country just don't have the resources or the inclination to trace the money across international borders. If you have money stolen from you, it's going to stay in the country certainly for a while.
I mean, surely the banks, the big banks, I mean, talking about your Lloyds, your UBS, they could, if they wish to, have quite a robust way of controlling and stopping the tracing of money which is effectively being used by organised crime. So is there any reason why they wouldn't do that?
Well, I think the sort of whole financial industry seems to have decided, well, it's just cheaper to refund the money in cases where our systems have been hacked into, or in cases where it's the customer's computer that's been hacked into, or the customer has been duped into handing over passwords and that sort of thing. I mean, they can just wash their hands of it. And people have lost thousands of pounds in that way. I mean, there's one particular scam where you're buying a house. You've got to send a deposit to the solicitor. Criminals hack into the solicitor's or your email account, send you an email which seems to come from the solicitor, says, oh, yeah, you transfer the money into a different bank account. And, of course, it goes into a criminal's bank account and is never traced again. And you might think it's just a simple case. Well, whose bank account has it gone to? But what criminals are very adept at doing is using other people's accounts to transfer the money through. So you find the money has gone into somebody else's account, then it's been extracted from there and sent around the world, and there's the electronic trail is extremely complex. I mean, I think they could eventually get on top of it, but we're being sort of pushed towards this cashless society we're not on top of that.
What about accusations that you're a bit of a Luddite? Because surely, I mean, just the fact that there's so much now transactions going on the internet, and there's so much of a need, or certainly a perceived need, for electronic money, aren't you just trying to hold back this technology, which is inevitable that it's going to take over?
I don't carry huge amounts of cash around with me. I have a debit card. I pay for things online. I'm quite happy to do that. When we're making that free choice, that's absolutely fine. There are other things that I won't have. I won't use a mobile phone payment systems. I don't believe they're secure. I don't use a contactless card because I don't believe that is secure.
I mean, have you got any evidence that they're not secure, these ways of paying?
Well, if you get hold of somebody's contactless card, you can go into any shop and buy anything up to £30, then go into another shop and do the same, and eventually you'll be asked for a PIN number or a PIN, that's a tautology to call it a number. You could extract quite a lot of money from somebody's account very quickly through the use of a contactless card. As for mobile phone payment systems, I mean, I you know, I don't know the technological details of how they work, but I know that people have their phones hacked into, and you know, I certainly don't want to pay for things that way.
Surely contactless is just getting so easy now. It's just blip. It's almost like as if you're passing over the cash, but there's nothing actually physically passing between you.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons the retail industry, of course, likes contactless cards, because it lowers our resistance to spending money. There's a rather nice report by the Dutch bank ING, which was quite honest about the way one of the reasons why cashless payments are being pushed at society. Said behavioral science suggests that when people do not handle money, they do not feel the pain. In other words, you know, if we've got to get a fiver out of our pockets, well, that hurts. But if you just tap your card against a reader, you've very little resistance doing that. So, you know, they think we can be persuaded to spend more money that way.
Well, you mentioned Sweden. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about how advanced the cashless society is going there. But there are also other countries that seem to be at the forefront of this, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of developed countries, Sweden it leads the way, or we can call it leading the way. I would say leading the wrong way. But yeah, there you go to banks that don't handle cash. I mean, you know, for example, there's a lady turned up at a local bank. She'd raised some cash at a village fair and wanted to bank it in her, you know, society's bank account. And the cashier said, well, cashier's probably the wrong term, isn't it? But person behind the desk said, I'm sorry, we don't handle cash anymore. We're an electronic-only bank. There's a lot of shops and restaurants now in Sweden which refuse to handle cash. Even the beggars on the streets in Stockholm, they've been issued with card readers, so that kindly folk wanting to give them money can do it via their cards instead. But yeah, I think one of the reasons why Sweden is why the Swedish banks are sort of pushing for the cashless society is that in Sweden 25 years ago, that they had a very near banking collapse, and people came very, very close to losing their savings. And obviously the bank's interest that they don't want us to have the option of putting our savings in banknotes and so on, because obviously it undermines their own position in the economy. But that's Europe. But it's interesting, some of the biggest push towards cashless payments are in the developing world. I mean, the largest number of mobile money accounts, that's, you know, accounts where you pay on your mobile phone, it's not in Europe, it's not in America, it's in sub-Saharan Africa. Kenya is the world's leader in mobile money, followed by places like Bangladesh and Asia. And, you know, what I find quite disturbing, really, is the way the cashless lobby are using the developing world as guinea pigs for this technology. There was a trial in Bangladesh where factory workers were paid exclusively in mobile money. They didn't have no option of receiving their money in cash. Well, the result was that, you know, there's about 40% of adults in Bangladesh are illiterate. They couldn't read the screens on their mobile phones. They couldn't use this. They couldn't access this mobile money themselves. They had to go to agents sort of sitting by the side of the road under large umbrellas and pay them to access their money for them. And, you know, what they do is say, you know, I've been paid on this mobile phone, can you turn it into cash? And, of course, the agents, you know, extract quite a handsome fee for doing that. And, you know, it's as if the cashless economy is as if consumers in the developed world are rather shy of using it. So the, you know, the cashless lobby has sort of hit upon the idea, well, why don't we push it on the developing countries instead? And there's a huge amount of money resting on this. To take a figure from the Boston Consulting Group, at the moment, banks and payment companies extract $1 trillion worth of revenues from handling payments. By 2023, they've all calculated, well, they could double that to $2 trillion worth if they can persuade or people can be forced to make cashless payments instead. So it just gives an idea of what the cashless industry sees in this.
Also, I understand India is another place where there's been a real attempt to reduce the dependency on cash by, for example, cancelling some of the higher denomination notes. Is there any reason why people, why that's a bad idea? I think they thought that there was quite a lot of forgeries, and so they decided to just get rid of them.
Yeah, what happened there was that the government last November withdrew the high denomination banknotes, which is about 75% of the currency in India. And the idea was that well, a lot of these banknotes in circulation, they're held by criminals, and if we withdraw them, people have to go to the bank and they'll have to say, look, these are the old notes. Could I swap them for some new ones, or could I pay them into my bank account? And at that point, you know, the bank would say, well, you'll have to fill in a form and how did you get this money and all this sort of thing. And they would therefore catch out a lot of criminals, or they would manage to basically cancel a lot of the criminals' wealth. But when it came to it, virtually all these old banknotes were handed in, and they were managed to change them for cash. So, you know, it completely backfired. But meanwhile, it caused huge disruption to the Indian economy. You know, people, particularly in rural areas with no access to banks, were simply unable to do business. They couldn't be paid, they couldn't pay for things. And of course, they were the people who lost out, you know, because there was a deadline of 31st of December. If you didn't hand in your old banknotes by that day, they would just be cancelled and you would lose the money. And, you know, a lot of people in rural areas, no access to banks, they found it impossible to meet that deadline. And it was they who lost out, you know, not the criminals.
Interesting, isn't it? I mean, also that these things are being tried out, like, as you said, almost like guinea pigs on the developing world. So over here, we've seen a sort of transition from the old cash and checks, I suppose that was kind of 1960s, 70s, through the credit cards, the debit card, a debit card payment that you sign for, and then the chip and pin, the latest being this whole contactless. The only trouble is there doesn't seem to have been any real meaningful either discussion, public debate about this move. I mean, to what extent are the banks simply just doing exactly what they want without any real check from the public or from Parliament or even from the press, the media?
Well, you're right. I mean, this whole drive towards cash, we're always told it's for our convenience, but it doesn't come from the public. It's not through public demand. What happened with the contactless cards? I mean, banks just sent them to consumers, said this is going to be your card from now on. You can use it in this way. And I was sent couple of contactless cards and I didn't want them, and I rang up the bank and I said, no, I don't think these are secure. I want a you know, a classic card where I have to use chip and pin. Now the two banks that I bank with, they did send me non-contactless versions, but there's other banks which say, no, you can only have a contactless version. And I say, I mean, that hasn't been arrived at by through a consumer choice. It's just been forced on the population.
One of the things I remember reading an article in the Daily Mail probably about 2 or 3 years ago now about people who actually were having money taken off of their contactless cards just through walking past a Marks and Spencer's, where they were walking very close to a checkout, and the fact that the card was in, you know, whatever, a couple of feet proximity of one of these contactless terminals, you could actually be paying for somebody else's shopping. You know, it doesn't seem as if it's really very secure, but yeah, it's well worth. I mean, they're also identifying how people know whether they've got a contactless card. It's got these kind of little, almost like, I think it's three or four kind of signs of a radiation wave coming from a dot on the card.
That's how you know whether your card is contactless or not. I mean, what you're referring to there, that was a trial by Which magazine, I think, where they tested these contactless cards. They're only supposed to be, you know, the card reader's only supposed to read them if they're within very, very close, within a couple of centimetres or something. But the you know, in the trials, they you know, they proved that they could be read from sort of 15 centimetres away. Well, that's, you know, you're walking past you know, somebody on the tube, you know, or in a crowd, can you know, if they've got a reader, a device which is able to read your card, it could theoretically dock money from a contactless card in this way.
I mean, you could actually, if you were a criminal, you could spend your day kind of just wandering around, taking whatever, £30 off of everybody that passes you by in the street.
Well, yes, theoretically you could, if you can get hold of the right technology. And I don't know that it's become a huge problem yet, but it's certainly a potential problem.
What about the cost of these transactions? That's one thing that they're really selling this on, is that there's very little in the way of fees, which, you, for example, if you're changing from one currency to another, obviously you have to pay a fee. With the electronic money, surely that's a lot easier than cash.
Yeah, well, in this country, we as consumers have become used to using debit cards without a fee. There are fees, though, for some credit cards. But overall, the cost of handling electronic money and electronic transactions, if you look at the overall cost, that paid by the consumer and that paid by the retailer, electronic payments cost more than cash payments. I mean, the British Retail Consortium has done the figures, taking into account, you know, the cost of hiring armoured vans to cart around the cash and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, they came to quite clear verdict that handling cash is cheaper than handling cashless transactions. But the costs are just a bit more sort of opaque, because you know, as I say, in this country, there's no charge on your contactless card or your debit card. But, you know, when I was in Sweden last year, I went to a restaurant with my wife, and we went twice, two nights running, we went to and had exactly the same meal. And once I paid with a debit card, and the other time I paid with cash. Now, I worked out what it was costing me in each case, and it cost me significantly more to use the debit card than it did to use the cash. You know, even when you take into account the charges of withdrawing cash in Stockholm. But, you know, when I went to the cash machine told me exactly what charges would be docked from my account if, you know, if I press the button and withdrew the cash. Whereas when I used the debit card in the restaurant, there was none of that. It didn't say you would be charged this, you will be charged that. It was only when I got home and looked at my bank statement, I realized that I'd paid £1.50 in a foreign cash transaction fee or foreign transaction fee, and I'd paid 2.5% or whatever it was of the transaction. You know, it was completely opaque, and that is the world we will be in if we, you know, allow ourselves to go cashless, because then the payments industry will be able to charge what it likes. It won't have what it now has, is the competition of this free option of using cash. And that is the important role of cash. Even if we don't use it every time we go shopping, we know it's there, the payments industry know it's there. It acts as a vital form of competition to stop you know, retailers and any banks and so on imposing fat charges on us.
Also, public transport is being used as a way to kind of train us, I guess you'd call it, to be using electronic money of one sort or another. I mean, it's impossible to use cash on public transport in London now.
On the buses, you have to buy a ticket before you board. You can't. I think you can use cash to buy the ticket if you go to the right machine. But last year, a couple of years ago, the government, the then Transport Minister, Rail Minister Claire Perry, she suddenly announced that plan to do away with rail tickets by about the year 2023. You know, we're all rail travellers said we'll go cashless, and we'd have, you know, our debit card would effectively become our ticket. I said, well, first this presupposes that everybody has a debit card. There's actually 1 in 10 of the population of Britain do not have a bank account, and most of us might find that extraordinary.
Well,
but
maybe they shouldn't. Maybe they shouldn't be travelling on the train.
Well, exactly. How are they going to travel? How do you travel if you haven't got a in a cashless environment, if you don't have a bank account? But, you know, where was this? Didn't come from any public demand. It wasn't consulted on by the public. It was just sort of suddenly announced. And where it actually come from was a report had been compiled by, you know, companies which had an interest in selling the Transport for London and other rail companies the technology. I mean, it's just a sort of huge lobbying operation, and the sort of cashless initiative seemed to bubble up out of nowhere.
Well, this is one of the things we're being told with this new Metro bus, which is about to be introduced here in Bristol after years of horrendous traffic delays. We're going to get a tiny little advantage to certain people who use this Metro bus to get in and out of the city centre, that none of that is going to be, you're not going to be able to use cash on that at all. So, I mean, it just bothers me, particularly with the use of mobile phones. I mean, what happens as you step onto the bus and your battery runs out?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, we're told we could use mobile phones. Every other day, if I'm out and about using my phone, by the end time I got home in the evening, it's run down. And, you know, if your mobile phone is your wallet, as we've said it will be in future, I mean, what do you do then? You're completely without money. You know, I mean, what is wrong with retaining cash as an option? You know, another thing is, what if the bank systems go down, as they do? I mean, there have been, you know, numerous failures of the payments infrastructure. Royal Bank of Scotland, some systems went down for a couple of days a few years ago. And in that time, people had no means of paying for stuff electronically with their cards. What the bank did on that occasion was it opened its branch and said, well, look, if you've got an account with us, come in and we'll give you cash to tide you over with. But, you know, what do we do if there's no cash? I mean, the whole economy would grind to a halt. And then there's also the issue of remote places. You know, if you're in a remote country location, often you can't get mobile phone reception, the broadband is non-existent. I mean, what do businesses do if they are in those locations? And, you know, I rather get the impression that, you know, a lot of this policy is sort of dreamed up by people who spend all their time in urban areas, in Wi-Fi spots and so on, and just don't appreciate the problems which you can have trying to make electronic communications in remote places.
Your book, Ross, is called The War Against Cash. What can we do? Is there anything we can do, or are we just being slowly shepherded down the road to a world of, you know, these contactless cards, maybe even the human microchip?
Well, yes, there are one or two people in the world have had microchips implanted in their arms to pay for their coffee at work and so on, which is a bit of an ominous development. But no, what the rest of us can do is we can just resist it. We make it absolutely clear that we want to use cash as an option for paying for things. Boycott businesses which refuse to take cash, make a fuss when any kind of public service goes cashless. And, you know, if we are if we make it clear, if consumers make it absolutely clear they want to retain cash as an option, then I'm sure that cash will survive as an option. If we just go along meekly with the underhand campaign to turn us cashless, then we will later regret it. Particularly, I mean, something we haven't talked about is negative interest rates, because in the last recession, there's a lot of governments, a lot of central banks would have loved to impose a negative interest rates where, you put £100 in the bank, go back a year later and find you've only got 95 quid left or something. At the moment, they can't impose negative interest rates on us because they know that a lot of us would withdraw our savings and keep them in the form of banknotes under the bed or something. But in a cashless world, then it would give banks, central banks, governments huge capacity to manipulate the currency in that way.
Do you have any truck with conspiracy theorists who talk about this mark of the beast, where the Bible says you're not allowed to buy or sell without this in your hand or your forehead, I think it says in the Bible?
I don't know about that, but I know there is a very big lobbying campaign going on to drive us cashless, which very few people are aware of.
Okay, Ross, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined by Zaria Phillips. She's the secretary of Bath Against the Cuts and also chair of Unite Communities. Now, is that just in Bath?
The Bath Against Cuts is, but the Unite Communities, my branch is Bristol, Bath, Gloucester, Stroud, Weston-super-Mare and all the villages in between.
Okay, well, maybe we better start there. What is Unite Community?
Right, well, Unite Community was brought into action about 5 years ago. Unite founded the community membership.
This is the trade union?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you just give us an idea of how big Unite is? It's a trade union and it's kind of various other unions have come together to form it, but how many people overall?
I would say there's about 1.4 million Unite members.
And some of them are full-time, some are part-time. What's the Unite Community, which you're chair of?
Right, well, Unite Community was brought into action about 5 years ago. Unite's mission to organise people that places equality, dignity, respect for everybody, realised that actually there was a community that they hadn't got organised. So Unite Community was born, making the trade union stronger by bringing in people who are not in paid employment, retired folk, students, the disabled, those in voluntary work, and getting us organised.
But I mean, surely the job of a union is to get people better paying conditions, more money, and if they're not getting paid anything, what's the point of the Unite Community?
Oh, that's been asked a few times. I think what we're finding is that ordinary people are struggling, whether you're on benefits, whether you're in the voluntary sector. And I think the issues is that, yes, of course, it is about people in the workplace. However, there is such a huge community of people that have been active all their lives, some people who have not ever been part of a union, who want to campaign on the issues that affect them. That could be the hospital closures, a doctor's surgery closing, a bus route to some of the bigger campaigns that we've got behind.
I mean, surely that would normally be the job of the political parties. Say, for example, here in Bristol, the opposition party. So you go to your councillor and you say, I want to keep this bus open, and they would be fighting your corner. So what role does Unite Communities play?
Well, Unite Community, we go out there, we talk to the community first of all, we find out what they want. If it was about a bus route, there may be issues with that, but we talk about to the community, we say, what is it you need? Can we help you? Are you a member? If you're a member, what would you like to do about it? So we give them the opportunity to do some training, some activism courses, just get them a little bit of confidence so that they can then look into the issues that they want to, you know, the places they want to save. I mean, a councillor is all very well, but we know that they don't do anything. They don't listen to
people. Sometimes they do. I mean, here in Bristol, the Lib Dems, for example, have been quite good at keeping some bus routes open that otherwise weren't, you know.
Good. No, I mean, it's great, but across the country as a whole, we don't have an awful lot of councillors that may be supporting us for the things that we think
are there important. Doesn't seem to be any way of actually making councillors answer the phone. It's one of the things I've found, for example. So what's the, in your mind, how is it, how do you separate what you're doing with Bath Against the Cuts from what's happening with Unite Community?
Well, I don't need to. Most of it is very similar. What we do is, as Bath Against Cuts, we're very involved in the Save Fox Hill campaign, which is, you know, a little bit about going on in Bath, which essentially is social cleansing. It's a knocking down of a council estate.
Okay, now, it's been in the news recently,
yes,
hasn't it?
Yeah,
it's,
yes.
As I understand it, maybe you can correct me, it's Curo Homes, which is a housing association, want to knock down a load of houses and build a load of new ones.
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, Curo own these properties and they want to demolish them and make some better properties. So surely there's no problem with that. Why should there be?
The issues are far deeper than that. The selling off of the council houses that people don't want to be moved out of is an issue.
So are they at council houses or are they owned by housing association?
They were council houses until the council sold them back into Soma in the early 2000s.
Oh, really? Okay, so these were originally built as council houses, they've been taken over by a housing association who now wants to demolish them.
And essentially it's for profit. Getting rid of people who don't want to leave their homes. They've lived in their homes all their lives. And the issues are is that they're not necessarily going to get the same property where they're building if you wanted it. People are finding that the houses that they have bought, they won't get enough money to buy one of the newer properties. And we've been having, there's another issue, if you've been a resident since 2013, you won't get a replacement home. So,
what will happen to your home then?
You'll be knocked down and you'll go back on the waiting list, which is essentially what it
Hang
is.
On,
is, take
that, is that for people who've bought their own homes?
Yeah. They haven't done the compulsory purchase thing yet, but, you know, there is an issue.
But surely they're going to get compensation and we'd be paid for the home.
They will do, but if you wanted to buy the same plot of land in the same area on the new build, you won't be able to afford it. You will not get enough money because the amount of the price that it is.
Okay, so I'm just thinking, hang on a minute, if those people who've bought their homes have got a freehold on the former council house, then Curo bought, which is now theirs, they don't have that. I mean, you know, surely someone can't come along and say, right, we're going to demolish your house and pay you X, Y, and Z.
No, I don't know, I'm not very good on the law, but as it stands, they're not being compulsory purchased as yet.
Right.
But I think.
But there's the threat there.
There
in
is
the background.
The threat.
Oh,
there
God.
Is the threat. And one of the issues is, of course, what he's doing, it's taking social housing out of the market. It doesn't matter how many they knock down and build, they are not building enough social. I think we're losing a total of 256 homes that other people would have to buy or be relocated to Taunton, as an example that happened, and we're losing 98 social housing homes. So taking those out of the market is not helpful, because the fact that people are losing their homes, they won't get a new one on the new plot.
But you know what people are like. If they're told this is going to happen, then they just have to sort of shrug and accept it. I mean, has there been much of a, you know, feeling in Fox Hill that something, you know, has there been, what's been the turnout, for example, for the public meetings up there?
The turnout has been huge, actually. It's been very, very good. But I do think one of the issues is that people who are mostly retired folk are very vulnerable and they don't feel they have the strength to want to fight things. They don't have an understanding on how you would do it.
But what's your thoughts about how it's all going to go? Do you think they're going to get away with this?
Know.
Have they got? I mean, how far down the line is it? Have they got planning permission for all of this, that sort of thing, the Curo?
No, that's all still being worked out. They have got an idea of where the land is and who's being knocked down. However, things haven't quite gone to plan for them. So they've had a stay of execution from the business secretary, But now he's given them the green light. So I think now it's a point at which we need to go to the public meetings. We need to talk to people. We need to find out really what's going on. Unfortunately, what I'm hearing is that Curo are now offering some of the people in the social housing homes a £5,000 payoff, which is if you're not in paid employment or you're retired, for whatever reason, it's a lot of money. So that is sort of buying them off.
Well, there's only one way to deal with that, folks, I would suggest, and that's get together and say,
yes,
and even if you are going to have a payoff, make sure it's 15,000, not 5,000, before anyone takes it.
I think we need to wait. You know, the issues are what we think they should do and what they would like to do. We have to make sure that we don't do anything that they don't want to do.
Yeah, so you're there to empower rather than to tell anyone what to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, that's one to watch, folks, because the idea that housing association should be knocking down homes to build more expensive ones, I don't think really, as far as I know, that's not housing association's job.
No, well, they're all turning
evicting people, you know, sending them eviction notices.
You can look at the
compulsory
whole,
purchasing.
I mean, I know you've seen the film Dispossession. London, what is happening there, the knock-on effect to they're losing their council homes. They're losing their council homes. They're being knocked down for private developers. They're being moved out. And at the same time, what is happening in London is that the prices of rent are going up, and that means people who want to live in London or who are working in London are now moving to Bristol. And in that case, because they can afford to rent in Bristol, but that's pushing the prices up in Bristol. So social housing, losing that is costing everybody. And that's, you know, that's an issue that we are looking at.
I can remember talking to the Grenfell Tower people,
yes,
in Ladbroke Grove,
yeah,
saying, well, when they say we're going to redevelop this area or regenerate this area, what they really mean is demolish it.
Yes, quite. Yeah, and that's what they're doing. There is one lady that's still in her flat in Southwark. You know, she's holding on there because they want to compulsory purchase it, and nothing's happened at the moment. But, you know, there's only
that's
a few
what
people.
We may be looking at Fox
think,
Hill,
yeah,
isn't it?
We are. But, you know, again, we have to wait and see what the people
what
want.
What they're talking about is Curo taking people out, obviously not killing them, but taking, you know, going one by one and saying, oh, well, here's an offer, we'll sort this out for you, until they've only got maybe one or two left.
Yeah, but
anyway.
But it is social housing, you know, it's going.
Okay, so here's the $64,000 question. What's the solution to the housing crisis? Because what it seems to me is we're just getting rents jacked up all over the place, wherever you are, whether it's a housing association. Actually, the government told them they had to reduce the rents, didn't they? But, you know, it's becoming almost impossible to afford rented accommodation. That what that means is that when you do get a job, you're finding that almost all your wages is going on rent. And that means, what does that mean? That means that work stops being a way of getting out of poverty. So how? What can we do about all this,
well,
Sarah?
We do need to build more homes, and we need to build good quality social homes, social housing.
But the government will
homes.
Say we don't want the price of houses to go down. We you know, because that actually sets the economy on a downward spiral. So
which I have to say isn't true. I mean, you build social housing, people live in it, people pay their rent, people work, they pay their rent. That rent then goes back into the market. It redevelops, it gives the quality of the housing, and it keeps the prices of private rented down. You know, that's what we're aiming for. We need more social housing.
I did a calculation along with a chap from Liverpool a few years ago. It costs around about £50,000 in terms of materials and labour to build a place, right? If you ignore the cost of the land, and that will be there for roughly 200 years, it's about £1 a week we should be paying in rent for houses. So if you actually look at spreading the cost of building a house over a long period of time, we're paying hundreds of times more than we should be. Anyway, that's just my beef. But look, that's not the only thing you're doing over there. What about, let's talk a bit more about Bath Against the Cuts, and, you know, how that's what the focus is there.
Well, at the moment, again, we're going, you know, with the Fox Hill, that's really important. I mean, as you will know, last week the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Bath stepped down. And that in itself is a win, because we've all been supporting the staff up at the university from UCU, Unison and Unite members to stop what seems to be happening is that she was getting paid an awful lot of money, and it was in excess of £468,000 a year plus all the perks, yet the staff at the Bath University, people I know who are lecturers, are on zero-hour contracts. And in fact, she got a wage rise, and I think her wage rise of 17 grand is more than some of the lower-paid staff in the university get in a year. You know, the inequality that's coming to somewhere like, you know, the issues that students are paying more.
It seems like there's no shame.
No, it did seem that was the point.
Maybe the message coming down there from the Vice Chancellor of a university is, we're going to teach you how to get as much as you can.
I don't know. I mean, I don't work up there, but what I could see is that the disparity between somebody who gets paid an awful lot of money and the people that really do the work on a day-to-day basis and working with the students.
I mean, isn't the reason that that happens is just simply because she can? She can pay herself what she wants,
absolutely,
effectively.
I don't know the result of them.
I mean, wouldn't you do the same if you were in a position to set your own wages? You'd be paying yourself £500,000 a year, wouldn't you?
Well, personally, probably not. So I wouldn't ask me that question. But they have had meetings, and they will be having more meetings as to how to address that sort of issue. And hopefully we'll resolve that problem. But you know, the students and the staff at Bath University are worth a lot more.
Surely most people, if they could, would pay themselves the most they possibly could.
I don't know if you live in a capitalist society. Yes, you probably do. But most of us want to have enough to live and to enjoy a good standard of life.
I suppose it's another thing to do with your self-respect, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you're stood on a podium as the vice chancellor of the university and people are sniggering at you behind their breath, that's not necessarily very dignified. But
now she doesn't
have to put up with it. She's off somewhere.
I think you'll find that she's now going to work until August next year, and then she's taken 6 months off as a sabbatical, so she's being paid. That's £700,000.
Maybe she's off to the Maldives or something.
Maybe
she's been given a job offer somewhere else. Who knows?
We don't know.
Anyway, so that's another thing you've been involved in. Mm-hmm. But I mean, ultimately, what's your strategy with Bath Against the Cuts? Have you got any? Because I mean, at the end of the day, this is all decided by central government. What can anyone in Bath do?
As a pressure group, you know, we go out, we talk to people, we find the issues that affect them, and we help them campaign on the issues that they want to campaign on. You know, with United Community, we're doing very similar, but, you know, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But with Bath Against Cuts, people bring issues to the meeting. We look at the issues and we say, what help do you want? And then we do that, whether it's getting them to petition the council, whether it's getting them into the council meetings, maybe it is lobbying. You know, we're just giving that opportunity for people. And issues come in. You know, we have a big group, which is Protect Our NHS, and we were supporting them when Virgin were trying to take over the contracts in Bath, which unfortunately Virgin got the contracts in Bath. But we did oppose that. Now what we're doing is we were looking at the issues that are now being raised because of the way Virgin are treating its staff.
How are they treating their staff?
They're not treating their staff very well. They don't like unions, so it's very difficult to get people organised in their workplaces. They sold their whole spiel for Virgin, selling it on IT. It was going to be brilliant. I went to the Health and Select Committee meetings. It was going to be absolutely fantastic. What we found now is that the IT system doesn't work, so people aren't getting paid. The nurses are having to write their own hand prescriptions because the printers don't work. They're getting into their cars after seeing a client. They're having to feed back via an iPad. You might not have any internet connection, but they're being made to work longer, but not with more care for their clients. So I think, you know, the issues are huge with Virgin.
Okay, so they're trying to do remote working, effectively. Yeah. They're saying, well, there's no office for you. Mm. You're working in your car,
working in
between clients or
And the clients, the staff are struggling because they don't want to let their clients down, and no way will they let their clients down. So longer hours, shorter, times with their clients, which is what they don't want. So the issues are with Bath Against Cuts. We're supporting the Protect Our NHS group. We do that. We have a group which is Bath Welcomes Refugees. We've got 9 families living in Bath, supported by Bath Welcomes Refugees from Syria, and we've supported them in any way that we possibly can.
Now, one of the things we hear quite a lot is that this whole thing of migrants, actually the real problem for a lot of people, not everyone, but for a lot of people, is economic migrants. What do you think about that, the idea that people coming to Britain really effectively, I mean, surely, you know, a union wouldn't normally be agreeing with people who've come over here to undercut wages. That's a difficult one for people
you. That's not for the union. That's the bosses not paying the staff. You know, that's an issue. You know, people, if there's work, people should be paid properly. Unfortunately, you know, the migrant population are being undercut. They're being made to work longer hours in not very good working conditions. And what we would do as a union is to try and protect them and make sure they are paid properly.
But with Unite Community, it's a bit different surely, because you've got a lot of volunteers and people like that. I mean, a union can surely only survive on members' subs. And if you're dealing with people who are volunteers, how much do they have to pay in subs to be part of the Unite Community?
Oh, we're 50 pence a week, believe it or not. It's £2.17 a month. And we get the same rights as you would do if you're in the workplace, apart from we're not represented in the workplace, because that's where we're not. So what we do is we pay a contribution to what it is we are as Unite members. We do look at fundraising. We do look at getting donations from the workplace branches if they, you know, because we support our industrial colleagues. We do. We're out there. If they need us, if they need us on the picket line, if they need us to rally round and get petitions signed, whatever it is that they need us to do, we will do it. So, we do talk to the workplaces. You know, and they support us in what we can do because they can't do the things that we can do.
I mean, one of the big things for the cuts in Bristol has been the 1,000 less teachers. What's the situation with education been like over in Bath?
It's dire. We've had one school which was turned into an academy that has now failed. What that means is that the kids that went to that particular school are now being shipped out all over the place. And a lot of those kids...
What was that, a secondary school, primary school?
Yeah.
Which school
was that? It was a secondary school that turned into an academy that now failed. So the kids are all being let down. They're all being shipped off. And a lot of them with special needs. You know, the issues around education are huge. I don't work in education, but the situation that you'll see a school that's being turned into something. There's another school that's very vulnerable in the most vulnerable part of Bath. 1 in 4 kids live below the poverty level. They've just lost their national lottery funding. They're not getting any more money from the council.
Why is a school being funded by the lottery?
Because they're not being funded properly by the councils and by government. Full stop. They're not getting the money they need.
I mean, some cynical people might say, well, that may be because they're in Labour areas.
They're not. Bath isn't, it was Lib Dem, then it was a Tory-led council, and now it's a Lib Dem council.
That was Zaria Phillips from Bath Against the Cuts and Unite Community for the whole region. And we'll be having more from her next week. That's all. For this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car, and you could subscribe and listen to the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, you just heard Zaria, and also to Ross Clark, author of The War Against Cash, and also to studio engineer Dave Pazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. From time to time, you can hear us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 on Tuesdays at noon. Sometimes all they seem to play is music, but anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Crofts, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. It's the only place, I'm afraid, since the cuts led to the close down of the Bristol Volunteer Centre, which had been going since the 1960s. Anyway, that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.